So in the last session, we were looking at anger and how anger is very destructive, and that even in very difficult situations, we don't need to resort to anger, that with the calm, clear mind of patience, we can respond using the strong force of compassion if necessary. So I think most of us appreciate how destructive anger can be, and it's something we really want to overcome. But often it's a different story with attachment. And not only do we often feel as if attachment is something that's not to be abandoned, but it's something that we actually need. And often one of the in Buddhism, of course, we talk about overcoming attachment altogether. But then often when people hear that, they sort of feel like, well, if I get rid of attachment, life's going to be very boring, very bland and boring. Actually, it's exact opposite. Exact opposite. Because now, and the reality is that our life is pervaded by attachment. You know, we looked yesterday at these realms of existence, and we had the desire form formless realm. It's called desire realm for a reason. And the reason is that the dominant factor in our life is desire or attachment. So it's something that dominates our life. And of course, it's something that is not easy to overcome. But in our experience of the simple pleasures of life, the sense pleasures, actually attachment interferes with our enjoyment of them. Because if we have strong craving and attachment, then that agitates the mind. And we know from our own experience that if we have strong craving or attachment for something, some pleasure, sense pleasure, then even if we get that, and of course then if we don't get the pleasure, we get very frustrated. But even if we do get the pleasure, if we have strong craving and attachment, often we don't really enjoy it fully because we're so worried about not getting enough of it or losing it. So we actually don't enjoy it as much as we could. And then often we overindulge, which then leads to suffering. You know, the classic example, of course, is the chocolate cake. You know, if we like chocolate cake and we have some craving and attachment for it, and then, of course, if we go down to our favourite little organic store in town, which has nice organic chocolate cake, and we go there and the person in front of us buys the last piece... but even if, of course, we get our favourite piece of chocolate cake and we have strong craving and attachment, then often we end up eating it very quickly and we don't really enjoy it. Or if we get quite a lot, we maybe eat too much and then at the end we feel sick because we've eaten too much. So actually, with strong craving and attachment, then we interfere. It interferes with the enjoyment of the sense pleasures. So actually, if we get rid of attachment, it's not like somehow then chocolate cake will become boring and we won't like it. If we get rid of attachment, it means that when we go to the shop and there's no chocolate cake left, we'll go, okay, tomorrow I'll get a piece. And then if we get it, we'll actually eat it slowly and actually enjoy it and don't eat too much. And so we'll actually enjoy it much more. And this was very much actually highlighted to me very strongly, in fact, in the very first time I did quite a long retreat. I did an 8-month retreat. And I tend to like to go to retreat places that provide meals because I personally don't like to cook. And generally in retreat places where they provide meals, they're quite nutritious and wholesome, but they tend to be quite the same every week, you know. And normally, even if there's food we like, but we get it every single week, week after week, then after some weeks, we're not liking it that much anymore and we're going, oh, no, not that again. But actually, it was surprising. So what happened is, you know, so the food was quite nutritious and quite wholesome and you know, not super tasty, but quite okay. And then what happened was, after a few weeks, the food started tasting better. And I'm thinking, wow, the cook's really putting more effort into the food and adding more spices or something. I don't know. But then after a few more weeks, I realized, actually, it's the same food. So not only was I not going, oh, not that again, I was actually enjoying it much more. Because actually what was happening is that being in retreat and meditating a lot each day, the mind starts to calm down after some weeks. You know, it takes quite, for me at least anyway, it takes some weeks before it starts to really settle down. And so then this sort of craving attachment mind over some weeks slowly settles down. And so what was happening was then my mind was much more calm and peaceful. And so I was actually tasting the food more than I normally do, because normally, you know, eat it quick or busy, you know. And so I was actually tasting it, and I was starting to really taste the flavours in the food, and it was really, really tasty. So I, after some time, realised that they were the same food, but it was just because my craving and attachment was, I mean, of course, I wasn't eliminating, it was just because of the meditation that it was sort of subduing a little bit. And also what I was noticing was, you know, I was in quite a nice place with an open view. But again, even if you're in a place with a nice view and you have the same view every single day, after some time you're, oh, that's boring now. You know. And what I was finding was the same, just little tiny things, you know, an insignificant little flower or piece of grass or something after some time, I go, wow, that's beautiful. I mean, serious. I mean, everything became more beautiful, more vibrant. And again, I sort of understood that, you know, that was because my craving and attachment was settling down. Because craving and attachment is always has this perspective. I want something bigger, better, different. Bigger, better, different. Bigger, better, different. So even if you enjoy something and you get it too repetitively, attachment goes, nah, that's no good anymore. Give me something different, bigger, better, different. So actually, we don't even really enjoy it. And then after some time, we stop enjoying it because attachment says that's not stimulating anymore. It's the same stuff. I want something different. So if we can get rid of attachment, we'll continue to enjoy the things we do. We'll enjoy them more fully. And we're going to start enjoying a lot of things that we find now boring. Because attachment goes, boring, 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 boring. Give me something more exciting. Whereas actually, you'd be amazed at little things, how beautiful they are. So anyway, this is my experience in retreat. And so I think if we really can reduce our attachment, I think this is the sort of experience you'll have as well. That actually the simple pleasures in life, you'll enjoy much more. Life will become much more beautiful. But then people can sort of say, oh, okay, maybe that could be the case. Let's see. But then often then people come up with a second doubt and they say, yes, but I need attachment for relationship. Without attachment, I wouldn't even be able to begin a relationship and I wouldn't be able to sustain it. I really do need attachment to have a relationship. But again, here, it's the confusion is understanding what attachment really is. And understanding how that is very different than love or loving kindness. Because often in a relationship, both of these dynamics are present. There will be genuine love, loving kindness, and there will be attachment present. And generally we tend to see this as one dynamic. And so then when Buddhism says, get rid of attachment, then people think, well, if I get rid of that, then, you know, it's like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. There's no more relationship, no more love or loving kindness. So here we need to really distinguish clearly between what is love and what is attachment. And part of the problem here as well with the word attachment is that how this word is used, or what this word is referring to in Buddhism and what it is referring into psychology, is not the same thing. So those, anyone who has a psychology background, of course, then in psychology, there are forms of attachment that we actively need to develop. If we don't have them, we're in trouble. Like often adult attachment, this idea of attachment theory that, you know, the strong bond between a mother and a child, we need to cultivate that. In psychology, I think this is called attachment. This is not attachment in Buddhism. So the same word is used to refer to quite different things. In fact, I've got a couple of definitions of the word attachment from psychology here. One is that its attachment is defined as an enduring emotional tie to a special person, characterized by a tendency to seek and maintain closeness, especially during times of stress. Another definition from psychology of attachment is a feeling that binds one to a person, thing, cause, or the like. Another definition is a feeling of affection for a person. And some synonyms for the word attachment in psychology is affection, devotion, regard, loyalty, love. So this is very different how that word is used in Buddhism. So remember, attachment in Buddhism is defined as a mental factor that sees its object as attractive, exaggerates the object's attractiveness, and then wishes to possess and hold the object. So I think this is quite different definition. So again, it's not so much that Buddhism and psychology are arguing with each other. It's just they're using the same word to refer to two quite different things. And so here then, how can we distinguish this attachment from love or loving kindness? So again, generally in Buddhism, it's much preferable to use the word loving kindness than love. Why? Because love normally for us implies some sort of intimate behavior. Whereas this word in Sanskrit and Pali, Maitri in Sanskrit and Pali is metta. This is defined as the wish for ourselves and others to be happy, or to have happiness in its causes. So actually, love or loving kindness, as we talk about it in Buddhism, is not an emotion. It's an aspiration. It's an aspiration for ourselves and others to be happy. That will lead to certain behaviours, but itself, that's why it's much better, I think, to use the word loving kindness than love, because loving kindness has more of an idea of this aspiration, this wish, this attitude. So what is the difference between loving kindness and attachment in a relationship? So, of course, love or loving kindness in a relationship is basically the wish for that person to be happy. And the fine print is without expecting anything in return. What we would normally call unconditional love, no strings attached love. Strings attached love is love polluted by attachment. And that sounds like the following, is that I will love you, and here comes the, as long as, here comes the condition, I will love you as long as you keep saying and doing things that make me happy. I'm going to love you that long. Otherwise, no. So that, of course, is love polluted by attachment. So very simply, the difference between the two is love is saying, I want you to be happy. Attachment is saying, I want you to make me happy. That's attachment. So attachment is all about me, 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 me. And actually attachment turns, in a relationship, turns the other person into an object to satisfy me. I think we don't like to be ourselves looked as an object. So attachment is very dehumanizing in a relationship because it really just sees the other person as an object to satisfy me. So what we really need to do then is understand that both of these dynamics are usually present, and to distinguish the two, to be able to identify the loving kindness part of our relationship, of our connection, and then to identify when attachment is coming in, to distinguish the two and increase the loving kindness part and decrease and try and eliminate the attachment part of in any interaction with our partner in a relationship. And also here, as we're going to see a little bit later in the Lam Rim, we're talking about what's called immeasurable loving kindness. And that is to develop this attitude towards everyone. So often in Buddhism we have this teaching about that we should love everyone equally. But what do we mean by that? Remember, to love everyone equally simply means to have the equal attitude of equally wishing everyone to be happy. So it's what we're trying to do is to develop that equal attitude, to have that same attitude towards everyone, that may you be happy, may you be happy. How we then express that same attitude will depend on the relationship. We would express that same attitude to our partner in a very intimate way and spend a lot of time with them. We would express that same attitude to our family members in a different way. We would express that same attitude to our work colleagues, our neighbours and people in the street in a different way and probably spend a lot less time with them. So when we say we want to love everyone equally, we're not saying we need to spend equal amount of time with everyone. This would be a disaster. We're talking about having an equal attitude, that's all. So this is how we are to really understand loving kindness versus attachment. Any questions about that?
You said that loving kindness is, as a term, is preferable to love, because love suggests intimacy. So I'd like to know if there is, I mean, it sounds like there is, if there is space in Buddhism for intimacy.
Oh, absolutely, sure, of course. Absolutely. I mean, yes. Yes, so again, as I said, is here we're talking about having that equal attitude of wishing to be happy. And then, of course, depending on the relationship, we would express that in very different ways. So, yes, of course, a wonderful way to express that with our partner is through intimacy, of course. But often attachment comes in, and then the intimacy is not so intimate, because then it's all just about me having some sort of gratification. I mean, that's not very nice, is it? I mean, for the other person. I mean, if we're on the receiving end of that, it doesn't feel nice, is it? If we can sense that they're seeing us as an object to satisfy them, it doesn't feel very nice to us, does it? So this we can try and eliminate. So we can be very intimate without going there.
Yep. There should be a point where that is, you know, that is affecting me, and I don't.
Yeah. So, if we reduce our attachment, then we, as a natural consequence, will start to have a positive impact on the people around us, because attachment feeds attachment. So, of course, what's going to happen in any, not just relationships, but any interaction where we are reducing our attachment, but the other person is playing the attachment game, they're going to find that uncomfortable. But that's good, because they need to see that their attachment is actually creating a lot of suffering for themselves. But again, here we need to use the skillful means of wisdom and compassion of knowing how to interact with that person. But from our side, and so this is often, you know, how can we help others? Is often one of the best ways to help others is to lead by example. And if we lead by example and reduce our attachment, then we're going to have that positive impact on others. Because remember, again, dropping attachment is not somehow distancing ourselves from that person. Actually, we're going to be closer because the attachment is not interfering with that. So that person will start to feel that. That person will feel that genuine love for them. And even though they might feel it a bit uncomfortable because of the no attachment, it really will have a positive impact on them, I think. Yes, yes. And this is also, you know, sometimes when people look at these things and they say, the goal of Buddhism is, you know, if something tragic happens, to be really just blank. This is not very healthy. Not healthy at all. But what often happens, of course, is if that something like that happens and we have a lot of attachment, then our sadness turns into grief, despair, and depression. And then 5 years later, we're still depressed because that person left us. I mean, like a very tragic example of that is, you know, two people maybe got married and spent their whole life together. And then at end of life, one of them passes away. And then, of course, people are very sad. But if they have strong attachment, that often turns into this grief, despair, depression. And even to the extent of hating that person for leaving them behind. I mean, that's attachment. I mean, that's not very nice, is it? You start hating the person because they left you behind. That's attachment. That's the result of attachment. So what you'll find is if you can reduce your attachment, you'll stop having that sadness slide into the grief, despair, depression and paralyzing you for weeks, months, years. You'll really... And what you'll find also, if you get rid of the attachment, not only will you have sadness for when someone close to you passes away, you'll have sadness for anyone passing away. Now attachment couldn't care less about people we don't know or don't care about. And sometimes if people that we don't like pass away, we may even be a little bit sort of a little bit happy about that. I mean, that's tragic. So if we can get rid of attachment, we can have that sadness for anyone passing away and then not allow us for that to paralyze us, and we can get on with our life. So this, I think, is what will happen if we can reduce our attachment.
So this is a sticky area, the mixing, and even with a Buddhist partner for me, like a teacher's cook, you know, it comes up in my face all the time. I just wonder if there are recommendations for further study. This is, yeah. This is a really interesting topic.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, in the whole area here, we're talking about the loving kindness and compassion, and then we're going to talk about bodhicitta and so forth. Then, of course, one of the classic texts that's studied is this Bodhisattva Charyavatara by Shantideva. That goes through all the six perfections and bodhicitta, and so that there's a lot of material in there. Also material for dealing with anger and so forth as well. So that is a text that is very widely studied. And then there was a point I wanted to mention there, but it slipped my mind now. It's gone, I think.
Not just in relationships, but with people in general, I constantly find myself in a situation where I will, whether it's attachment or not, that they're doing something that's...
Oh, yeah, sorry, just before you asked the question, I remembered now. You said it was sticky, this difference between attachment and love.
In practice.
Yeah, so One way of checking how much attachment's creeping in is, what's the state of our mind? Is it agitated or is it very peaceful? If our mind is very agitated, that's a sure sign attachment is really dominating. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, sorry.
That
yeah.
was totally worth bringing up.
Yeah.
Trying endless different ways to point out that people are doing things that's making them suffer.
Yeah.
They go insane.
Right.
Okay, no matter how much compassion or you have to try, that devastates me.
Right.
So
you mean people telling you or you telling them?
No, I can tell them.
Okay.
I see them doing destructive stuff. And
sure.
They mistake again the fusion. They think I'm criticizing them, but
sure.
I can't
yeah.
ever seem to separate the two.
Yeah. So, again, a couple of points there is... if someone is very closed in their perspective, then often trying to explain to them that their behavior is harmful will just make it get them upset. So when people are very closed in that way, again, one of the best ways to help them is lead by example. Lead by example. So that's one point. We should never try and force anything onto anyone. We know from our own experience, if someone is forcing something onto us, even if it's the best thing for us, we usually reject it because we don't like anyone forcing anything to us, even if it's really the best thing for us. So never force anything onto anyone. And also in these difficult situations, as you mentioned, it's very important to avoid cognitive fusion. It's very important how you speak. You know, when we're addressing difficult behavior, we do not want to direct at the person at any cost because they're just going to react. They're going to feel personally attacked. So we need to direct our loving kindness and compassion to the person so that they can feel connected to us, but at the same time skillfully address their behavior. So we need to make sure we use language where we're addressing their behavior and not directing at the person. You know, like, do you realize that this behavior here creates a lot of suffering or so forth? Not like, you really, you're a bad person, or, you know, you're an angry person or something like that. Using that language will just get them to react. So we need to make sure we have language that is really directed at the behavior and at the same time have this sort of compassionate attitude towards the person. But again, when people are very closed, particularly if they're in a mental affliction, if they're in a very defensive frame of mind, sometimes wisdom says, okay, now's not the time to say anything because it's just going to, they're not open enough, and then try some other time. But it's difficult. Of course, the bottom line is it's difficult.
At that point where you have to back off, just patience is kind of, you just got
to
accept.
Yeah, you've got to use your wisdom to say, well, whatever I say now is just going to look like throwing petrol on the fire. It's not going to help, so there's no point. So let me back out here a bit and wait till they maybe calm down a bit more and they're in a better frame of mind, and then I can try to address this. So, yeah, it's not easy, of course, but that's all we can do. And in some cases, the only thing we can do is lead by example. At least we can do that. Okay. One last point on attachment, then we'll move on. Sometimes there's also this doubt, or people bring up saying, okay, I can sort of understand if I reduce attachment, I enjoy sense pleasures more. And if I reduce attachment, maybe my relationships will improve. But I'm a creative person. You know, I'm an artist, a musician. I need attachment. Without attachment, I can't be creative. Big misunderstanding. Of course, it's very true that mental afflictions like craving, attachment, anger, jealousy provides a lot of fuel for the creative process. Songs and no doubt. But what is the underlying cause of creativity? That provides the fuel, but where does the creativity come from? It doesn't come from mental afflictions. Creativity comes from a deeper level of the mind. And as long as the surface of our mind is agitated with attachment and anger and so forth, it's hard for that creativity to come through. It comes through more when these mental afflictions have subsided. And this is what you're going to notice, particularly in this shamatha-style practice, if you do start to do a little retreat on that, and I think there was a question related to this came up earlier, is that you're going to notice all these great ideas popping up. Sometimes like a flood of them will come up. Why? Because our mind is relatively still. There's no turbulence at the surface. And so this creativity can come through more. So if we reduce and eliminate our mental afflictions, your creativity will increase. Also now, often our creativity can be a little bit selfish. You know, look at me, how wonderful a musician or artist I am. Whereas if you get rid of the mental afflictions, your motivation for being creative will become much broader. I think the truly great creative people on this planet are the ones who use their creative talents to inspire others for a good purpose. So what you'll find is as you reduce your mental afflictions, not only will you become more creative, but your motivation will be more pure. You'll be wanting to use your creative talents to not as sort of a way of boosting the ego, but rather using it to inspire people around you in a good way. So if you're a creative person, then this is what we need to do. I mean, I think we all are creative in some way. So basically the bottom line is if we reduce attachment, we'll enjoy simple pleasures in life more, our relationships will improve, we'll become more creative. So, win-win-win. Okay, what I'd like to do now then is look at this chart here, suffering and its causes. And this is related to the next outline in your text here, where it in the middle it says the order in which the afflictions arise. It says here, once there is a self, that means grasping, this ignorance grasping onto this me, there is the idea of other, another. On behalf of self and other, there is attachment and hostility. All the faults come about in association with these. So this is actually a quote from great Indian master Dharmakirti from about the 7th century. So let's have a look at what Dharmakirti is saying there using this chart. And we have a similar quote here at the top from Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna was from the 2nd century, and he's very famous for writing this very famous text here called The Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way, where he was presenting this view of emptiness that the Buddha taught in these Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, which we're going to look at later. And so one of the verses in this text is listed here, which says, by extinguishing actions and mental afflictions, there is liberation. We already saw that earlier in one of the Lam Rim quotes. Actions and mental afflictions arise from misconceptions, and misconceptions arise from elaborations. Elaborations will cease through cultivating emptiness. So let's have a look at what that really means by looking at those steps following.
But is that in our text, that quote?
Sorry?
The quote you just read, is that in our text? You couldn't find it. Oh, it's on
the screen. Yeah. Oh, yeah, the Nagarjuna one. Yes, yeah, at the top of your chart.
Thank you. Where was the other quote, the first quote you read?
It's on middle of page 17.
Okay.
There's an outline, the order in which the afflictions arise. You see that in the middle? The order in which the afflictions arise. There's the quote there. So that's quoting from Dharmakirti, who is also a great Indian master from the 7th century. So let's have a look at what both of those two great Indian masters were talking about with this 6 steps here. So here at step 1, we have seed of ignorance. So ignorance here is this ignorance misunderstanding reality. It's this ignorance that's grasping onto the belief that there's an independent me here and an independent objective world out there. And the seed of ignorance is the habit of doing that. So we've had this habit since we were born, or way before that, according to Buddhism. So that's what seed of ignorance means. The habit of grasping on to an independent me, independent world. Then when we look out on the world, everything that appears to us appears to exist independent of us. And as we're going to see later in the Vipassana section of this text, these appearances are deceiving us, that things do not exist in the way they appear. Even though things appear to exist independent of us, they do not exist in this way, which means this appearance that we are receiving is mistaken. So that's what it means here, mistaken dualistic appearance. That things mistakenly appear to be independent of us. There appears to be this duality, subject-object duality. So everything that we experience appears to us in this way. And of course we have the habit of believing that. So we never question these appearances, because everything always appears to us in this way. We've never seen things in another way. And if we ask anyone else, everyone else will agree with us. So we never have a reason to question these appearances. So we just automatically accept them, which leads to step two. Which is ignorance. So ignorance is just automatically accepting that. Yes, there's independent me here, independent world there. And then, as we saw earlier, in every one of our experiences, there is this mental factor of feeling present. Meaning that we experience things as either being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So let's say we're looking at these flowers here. These flowers appear to exist independent of us. We have the habit of believing that. So we just automatically accept, yes, there's some flowers, they're independent of me. And let's say when we look at these flowers, we are having a pleasant feeling, a pleasant experience. Then that pleasant experience, together with this belief that those flowers are independent of us, will lead to the third step, which is misconception. Because if we're having a pleasant experience and we're believing that those flowers are existing independent of us, we're going to naturally assume that there must be some attractive quality there that's causing my pleasant feeling. So we're going to see these flowers as inherently attractive, that there is some beauty, attractiveness there. Or, if we're having an unpleasant feeling, together with the belief that those flowers are independent of us, we're naturally going to assume there must be some unattractive quality there that's causing my unpleasant feeling. So we'll see them as inherently unattractive. Or if we're having a neutral feeling, we'll see these flowers as having inherently neutral qualities. Of course, neutral just means neither unattractive or attractive, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So once we've got to step three, meaning we're seeing these flower is either inherently attractive, unattractive, or neutral based on our feelings, then of course it's very easy to go to step four. Meaning Because let's say again, we're looking at these flowers, we're having a pleasant feeling, and we're seeing these as inherently attractive, then of course I like pleasant feelings. I want pleasant feelings. Those flowers seem to be causing my pleasant feelings. I want those flowers. Attachment. Or if I'm having an unpleasant feeling, these flowers seem to be inherently unattractive. I don't want unpleasant feelings. I don't like them. Those flowers seem to be causing my unpleasant feeling. Get them out of here. Aversion. Or if I'm having a neutral feeling, what that will simply do is it will reinforce my belief that these flowers are existing independent of me, which of course is ignorance. But often here, that instead of using the word ignorance, we see the word confusion. But this is not confusion about, oh, are these flowers or not? It's confusion about how they exist. So it's just another word for ignorance. So these mental afflictions, the three poisons then, can also lead, of course, to all the other mental afflictions. And then these mental afflictions are what's driving our behavior. And of course, every time we do a certain behavior with a motivation, that has a result. And of course, the result of all of our actions is our experiences. And our experiences collectively, the Buddha described using the word dukkha. So this is how, from what Dharmakirti and Nagarjuna were saying, how we end up in our current state of dukkha because of our false view of reality. And so then if we look at these six steps, we can see that this first five, we're talking about the mental afflictions. The fifth step is the karma or action. So those two together, of course, was the second noble truth, the truth of the origin of suffering or dukkha. And of course, dukkha, the result, is the first noble truth, the truth of suffering or dukkha. So this is the process of how our mistaken view of reality is the root cause of our current condition. Yes.
Attachment the same as craving?
Can be, or craving can be more specific. Again, there are many words that are sometimes used here. Sometimes you also see the word desire. There are, like with the aversion, there are many flavors of that. So sometimes, again, you'll see here people prefer to use the word desire. Sometimes they use the word craving. And I think sometimes these different words have slightly different connotations in different perspectives, but they're all flavors of the same thing, this sort of wanting pleasant things.
Well, it's like a list of the 12 links, depending on origination, lists craving.
Yeah.
There's no attachment in that list. Is that...
Yeah, so I'm going to talk about these 12 links. I think they're coming tomorrow morning. And in that particular case, that craving is a very specific type of craving or attachment. It's not in general. But I'll explain what it is when we get there tomorrow. So that's a specific type. And it's that link is particularly talking about the craving or attachment that comes at the time of death. But more than that, we'll look at tomorrow morning.
So this is why when you escape the attachment, aversion, confusion, you no longer create karma.
Correct. Exactly. So remember, karma here is action. The full thing here is contaminated action.
Right.
I mean, of course, if we get rid of this, it doesn't mean we stop behaving.
Right.
But
Here, action is talking about actions motivated by the mental afflictions. Those sorts of actions will cease, of course, because the mental afflictions cease. Yeah. Yeah.
So this really made me think, especially when you're using the flowers as an example, one thing that drives me nuts, weed. The word weed, I don't mean marijuana, but I mean weed as a plant that is just, you know, weed equals pesticides and we got to go on a war against the dandelions and then we all end up sick. And this is all ridiculous. Is there a way, I mean, could you kind of reverse that real quick to take weed back to normal? Or not just for me, but even if I'm talking to somebody?
I mean, again, of course, that's sort of an example of cognitive fusion, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, of course, in our language, certain modes of speaking have been established, so it's hard to...
Oh, that was really hard, yeah.
But, I mean, you could... I mean, sometimes people, instead of weeds, they go, oh, wildflower, you know. It's a wildflower.
Right.
Often they are. But, you know, because they're not cultivated, they're labeled as weed. So maybe we just change the label would be good.
Okay.
Up above that, I don't know if it's just cut off from the handout, but it says something like the stain.
Yeah, that's coming next.
Perfect.
Okay, so let's go there now then. So the question could arise here then, you know, we said here that the way in which things appear to us is not how they exist. This mistaken dualistic appearance. So then the question could arise is, well, if that's not how they exist, why do they appear like they exist like that to us? Why? Mm-hmm. And that's the last part of the diagram. Every time we have this ignorance operating, this, of course, reinforces the habit. So it's like a little tight loop there. But also, this ignorance has a side effect, which here is translated as latency or stain of ignorance.
Okay, so that's cut off in our...
I noticed that the... So here, when you have those two lines going out, you can join them together so that it sort of should be going back.
It's the whole A4, A4.
Yeah, A4 letter problem. Yes. And then up the top, of the, it should be as said in Nagarjuna's. And then further down, it's, of course, ignorance. And then just below that, it should be the two obscurations. So this latency of ignorance sometimes is called stain. And what that is that this ignorance, when we have it, not only strengthens the habit of ignorance, but has a side effect. And to describe what we mean by this latency or stain, often in the text they use this analogy. They say, imagine you have a bowl and you have a clove of garlic. And you put the garlic in the bowl. So the garlic, of course, is like the seed or the ignorance. Even if you take it out, there's still the smell of the garlic. The bowl has been stained by the smell. So this stain of ignorance is a bit like the smell of the garlic. What does this stain of ignorance do? It means that when you come into contact with an object, then you are seeing these objects through this stain. It's like a filter. And that's why everything appears to exist independent of us. It's these stains which are acting like a filter for objects to appear always in this mistaken way. And so that's then what is mentioned down the bottom as the two obscurations. So I'll just briefly mention that now. And that is... Early on, we said that we can strive for personal liberation, the goal of nirvana, and that enlightenment was a further step. To achieve nirvana,
We need to get rid of ignorance and mental afflictions. That is down the bottom here called afflictive obscurations. Conception of inherent existence along with its seeds, which is ignorance and the seeds of ignorance. But often these afflictive obscurations also then include all the mental afflictions that come from that. So you can either just have the afflictive obscurations as ignorance, or ignorance plus the mental afflictions. This is what we need to get rid of to achieve, to overcome dukkha, to achieve nirvana. But even if we achieve nirvana, we still have these stains. They're very difficult to get rid of. So that's what's called here the cognitive obscurations. If we want to go from nirvana to enlightenment, we have to get rid of these stains. Very difficult to get rid of. But that is what we need to do to progress from nirvana to enlightenment. We need to get rid of these stains which are causing this mistaken dualistic appearance. What that means, of course, is that someone who's achieved the goal of nirvana, and someone who's achieved the goal of nirvana is an arhat, even an arhat, when they look out on the world, things appear to be independent of them. But because they've realized emptiness, they have directly realized these appearances are deceiving us, so they never buy into them. So they never cause them a problem. An arhat then goes on to eliminate these stains and become Buddha. So when we become enlightened and we become Buddha, then things don't appear to us in this way. What that really means for us is unimaginable, because we've never experienced that. But for them, the world doesn't appear to exist independent of them. Again, we could only, I mean, it's just unimaginable for us. What would that be like? Yeah.
So it says afflictive obscurations, conception of inherent existence.
Yeah, that's ignorance.
Does that refer to the self, conception of the self as inherently existent?
It refers to conception of all phenomena to be inherently existent. The self, the body, the mind, the cup, the flowers, everything in general. So when it says conception of inherent existence, it means all phenomena.
Do you know the word for stain in Tibetan or Sanskrit?
Bakchak.
Bakchak?
Bakchak.
Okay. Can you spell that?
B-A-G-C-H-A-K.
Something.
Bakchak. Kak. I mean, the problem is that in Tibetan, a lot of these Tibetan syllables, that there is, often they're in between like G and K. And so, you know, how do you spell it? It depends a little bit on, so it's difficult.
I'm mainly looking on Sanskrit too, yeah. So I'll track it down.
Yeah, sure.
This sounds a lot like what people go to shrinks to get over, like their phobias. I mean, this sounds like you're describing a phobia.
Phobia at what level?
Well, between number one and number two, where
where
you can get, excuse me, to the point where you just see something and you panic. You're in a complete panic.
Mm.
You know, afraid of spiders, afraid of snakes, afraid of heights. It sounds a lot like all of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think a difference here, of course, is that this is based on an appearance. Where I think phobia is we fabricate stuff above and beyond. I mean, of course, this is a fabrication, but it's based on a valid appearance. It's not like, you know, we're looking here and we're seeing some snake or something. So, in fact, often we talk about these levels of fabrication, and of course, at a more gross or coarse level of fabrication, we're not only fabricating that things are existing in not existing in the way they appear, they're existing as they appear. We're fabricating, we're putting something on that, but we can also hallucinate and see something other, some other thing. So that's a sort of another level of fabrication. So this can come at many levels. But it's a similar idea, yeah.
Can we say something like we wear a colored glasses, like sunglasses, and ends up seeing everything with the additional...
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I use that analogy here, that these stains is like, you know, are wearing green sunglasses. If we wear green sunglasses, everything appears green. So, but this is like we've worn green sunglasses our entire life. So if someone comes to us and says, hey, not everything's green, some things are red and yellow, we'll go, you're crazy. Look, look, everything's green.
There is no red.
You know, what's red? What are you talking, what's this red thing? It's, yeah, it's like that.
So in our heart knows they're wearing the glasses but can't take them off.
Well, yes, that's right. And our heart's wearing the glasses, but see, in the meditation, when they realize emptiness, they've temporarily taken it off. But then in daily life, they're back on. And then they know that they're wearing green sunglasses and that this is not how things are. So it doesn't cause them a problem. Yeah. A Buddha has taken off the sunglasses. An arhat has only taken them off in meditation. They can't get them off in daily life yet because this is tough to get rid of. Okay. Yeah. Okay. One point, and then I want to also look at this list in a practical way, is we need to be careful that through understanding this, we don't flip to the other extreme, that nothing really exists. You know, like if we, for example, see these flowers and we have a pleasant experience and we see them as attractive, normally we feel as if the beauty is there. But then when we look at this, we can easily flip to the other extreme of going, well, there is no beauty, which is just fabrication. This is the other extreme we need to avoid. And so the philosophical school that we're going to be following later in the Vipassana section is often referred to as the Majjhimika, the middle way school. So we're trying to find the middle way between these two extremes. The two extremes of overinflating existence and the other extreme of thinking, well, then nothing really exists, nihilism. So we're trying to find our way in the middle. So then if we are having, seeing this flowers as attractive, where is the beauty? If the beauty is there, it would mean that everyone who saw these flowers would have to see them as attractive because it's there. But everyone who looks at these flowers, I'm sure, doesn't see them as attractive. So there's no beauty in the flowers. But then people think, oh, well, then I'm just hallucinating, I'm fabricating. No, that's the other extreme. So to understand how that beauty exists is the what we're trying to discover. And that's what we're going to be looking at in the Vipassana section. But there's a nice little saying in English, which I think it sort of relates. You know, we often say beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And if we understand that in a right way, that can be the middle way. But it doesn't mean that it's just mere fabrication. What it means is, it says, in the eye of the beholder, which means for beauty you need two things coming together. But anyway, more than that we'll look at. What I'd like to do now then is, so what we can understand from Nagarjuna's quote here is, oh, this word elaboration in Nagarjuna's quote is another word for ignorance. That he says that actions and mental afflictions arise from misconceptions. And misconceptions arise from elaborations. So often you'll see this word elaborate, elaboration. It's another word for ignorance. And then it says, elaborations will cease through cultivating emptiness. So by realizing emptiness, that there is no independent, nothing exists inherently or independent, we can overcome ignorance, overcome then dukkha. So that's the long-term solution, is to overcome ignorance. But it's also helpful to have a short-term strategy. So what I'd like to do now is go through this list again and look at practical ways in which we can at least interrupt this process or slow it down or minimize the impact. Because we don't want to go here, particularly when we're talking about actual unpleasant experiences. So let's say we're at step one, that we are contacting an object, it's appearing to exist independent of us, we have the habit of believing that. Can we do something now in a practical way to stop to go to step two? Anything or no hope?
Just remind ourselves.
Yeah, so exactly. The point here is, as with every practice has two parts, remember? What you do in meditation, what you do in daily life. So as we're going to see in the Vipassana section, the meditation practice of emptiness is called space-like emptiness. And I'll explain why it's called that. The daily life practice of emptiness is called illusory-like emptiness. Meaning, in daily life, we are to not just accept appearances. We are to question appearances. That, yes, this flowers really appear to exist independent of me, but based on my contemplation and meditation, I know that that's not how they exist. And so, as you said, to remind ourselves and to keep questioning appearances. But to be able to do that effectively, of course, requires that we have an understanding of emptiness and we even start to have a little taste of that in meditation. But yes, this is what we can do. But let's say we couldn't manage to do that and we got to step two. So at step two, we are, and we'll take the flowers as the example again, we are believing these flowers existing independent of us, and let's say we're having a pleasant feeling when we see them. What can we do something at step two to stop to go to step three, four, and on? Can we sort of interrupt the process at step two?
Can you present an alternate example in your mind of someone who may not view the flowers as beautiful?
Yes. That's one thing we can do, is that we can... But that one probably works better here, is that when we get to step three and we're really seeing them as attractive, that there really seems to be beauty there, then more effectively, then we can go, well, hang on, if that's the case, then everyone should be seeing it the same way, but I'm sure there are people who don't see it like that, so maybe it's not like that. So that can work and probably maybe works better here. But yes, this is a good point, is to understand that even though this object is appearing inherently, really inherently attractive or unattractive to me, I know that's not the case for everyone. Therefore, there can't really be an inherent beauty or ugliness there. So that can help, yes. What else? There's step two. And this is a step that's very much emphasized in many Buddhist traditions, particularly Theravada traditions.
Just being mindful of the arising of the feeling.
Exactly. Is to simply, with mindfulness, to be mindful, to be aware of the pleasant and unpleasant feeling or sensation as it arises. So, of course, any of you who have done a Goenka Vipassana retreat know exactly what I'm talking about. In that retreat, which is coming from the Burmese tradition, the emphasis is on the physical level. Because in every experience we have of pleasant, unpleasant experiences, we can have pleasant, unpleasant experience at the physical level, the body level, and the mental level, both. So we can focus on either one or both. And in that tradition, the emphasis is focusing on the body, the physical level. So there the instruction is to simply observe pleasant and unpleasant sensations in the body without reacting, just observing them arising and passing. Equally well, we can simply observe pleasant and unpleasant feelings arising in the mind. Just observe them arise and pass without reacting. So that will cut here and it will stop us going down to the acting on those with attachment and aversion. So this is one very effective method to minimize the impact of this process. But to be able to do this, of course, in daily life, we need mindfulness. Because even if we have the best intention in the world, I'm just going to be mindful, it's not going to work. So that's why also the shamatha practice is where we are cultivating mindfulness, we are strengthening that muscle of mindfulness in shamatha practice, then in daily life, it becomes easier to be present with everything we experience in daily life. And then when we're present, is to simply notice pleasant and unpleasant feelings or sensations arising and just observing them arise and pass without reacting to them. Question?
So isn't seeing the flowers, is that the sense pleasure? Like seeing something beautiful?
So the question is?
Like seeing the flower, isn't that like a sense pleasure of like that's something beautiful that's come up, like and enjoying it for what it is and letting it pass? Am I confusing this with?
No, that's right. So here, this is what we're talking about, is that and this, of course, can mean sense objects, but also mental objects. We're not just talking sensory, because, you know, you may have a memory come up, a pleasant memory, and you have a pleasant feeling with that. Or you look at the flowers and you have a pleasant feeling. So we can talk about both at this stage. We can talk about our experiences based on sensory experience, but also mental experience. You know, we're getting some pleasant or unpleasant memory coming up, for example. Or mental image, some pleasant mental image coming up. So both can apply here. Yeah?
I just realized this concept has the power to destroy systems.
Destroy systems.
Like capitalism.
Oh,
okay. Like if you're really hard to work yourself up into buying a new car.
Yeah. I mean, of course, if our car is completely collapsed and it's costing, we'd buy a new one. Yeah.
Yeah,
of course. I mean, and you know, I also saw another thing on the internet recently, is you know, they had this graph of this was level of happiness. And this was the wealth. And as you'd expect, you know, if you have zero wealth, you're going to be struggling. So initially it was going like that, as you'd expect. But then it was interesting what happened was when they got to a point where that wealth was enough to satisfy their needs, then when they got to that point, instead of it going like this, it went like this.
Well, if they're switched.
Yeah.
Sorry? You're right. Yeah. Happiness and wealth, you're right. So this was what the study found. And also in a very similar study I saw, they interviewed super wealthy people, you know, like billionaires, and they were basically all very unhappy. But they still said that actually, on average, if they had 25% more money, they'd be more happy. Still. So even though they were billionaires and unhappy, they still were having a belief that it was because they didn't have enough money. And that on average, if they had 25% more, they'd be more happy.
Well, that's single-minded. This is probably how they got there.
I mean, how deluded is this?
I know.
It's all in their head.
Well, of course, they've invested their whole life in this idea, so they're not going to give it up easy.
Right. To go back to the previous one,
yeah.
The previous page.
There's
many meditations or visualizations, I think, where you meditate on the impermanence of things and the flower being now decayed and ugly, or people the same way.
Yeah.
Where does that...
That can also be very helpful here. Because this ignorance is at a number of levels, and one of them is to grasp onto as static. So also the same thing, at this level here is if we really internalize this idea of impermanence, that things are changing moment by moment, then also here it's going to be hard to get down here because there's no solid object there that is just a flow. So in fact, particularly when we look at antidotes to attachment, one of the key antidotes is impermanence, is to internalize impermanence, to come to realize things are changing moment by moment. So if we can realize that, that will also be very helpful at this point to avoid going to this misconception and attachment. Yes, that's a very good point.
But okay, I understand focusing on the on how it passes, but if you focus on how the beauty turns to ugliness, aren't you just reinforcing it? Because it's still a judgment of sorts. It's still a...
Here we're not looking at beauty or ugliness, we're observing the feeling.
I know, but saying that in dying it becomes less attractive...
We're not saying anything like that here.
I thought that was the meditation he was talking about.
Oh, that's a different one. I wasn't talking about that one. I was mainly talking about the impermanence, that things are changing moment by moment. That's all.
Right, okay.
Yeah. And there was something else I wanted to add now, but it slipped my mind. No, it's gone. Okay, maybe it'll come back. But let's say we couldn't do that here, and we're down here at the misconception. We're seeing it as inherently attractive and unattractive. So there, we've already mentioned that if we're getting to the point where that object is seeing so attractive, so unattractive, then we can also go, well, if it's there, then everyone should be seeing it the same way, but everyone doesn't, so that's not really how it is. So that can also be very helpful here at the stage of misconception. But let's say we didn't manage to do that, and we're down at this level here, 4, where we have attachment aversion arising based on our pleasant, unpleasant feelings. So what can we do at step 4 to avoid acting on that?
Bring it down a notch? Not get so worked up by the thing, it's just a flower.
But how? I mean, practically how? I mean, it's good to say don't do it, but what would be the mechanism to allow you to do that?
To undo the exaggeration, to try to remind yourself of the actual qualities.
Yeah, I think this is probably a little bit earlier in the process. Yeah, I mean, the fact that we've got to attachment, we've passed that point of no return. So what can we do at step 4?
Impermanent.
As well, again, is to reflect on impermanence, but again, very simple answer.
Yeah. Able to disconnect from it.
Yeah. This as well, but even more simple than that.
Recognizing it?
Exactly. Ooh. Observing.
Observing the agitated.
Huh? So the point here is similar to point 2, is when we notice some attachment or aversion or any mental affliction arising, is just observe it. Do not get caught up in it. Is simply observe it, arise and pass. Arise and pass. And this is one of the benefits of the shamatha practice that we're going to start doing tomorrow morning before breakfast. We've been using the breath up until now. Tomorrow we're going to start to use the mind, to observe the mind and whatever's arising in the mind. And often what arises in the mind is lots of mental afflictions and also thoughts and other things as well. So in that shamatha practice, if we get in the habit of observing these mental events arising in the mind, then in daily life, we're going to start to have that habit. And so then the trick, of course, here is to catch them early. Because often these mental afflictions, we only notice them when they're very strong. Often it's too late. By that time, they've taken control of our mind. We're out of control. There's not a lot we can do. Maybe we have to get away from the object because we're out of control. So with mindfulness again, we can catch this attachment and aversion as it's arising. We can notice a little bit of irritation and agitation arising. And then we're still in control. And then we can simply watch it as it arises and passes. Because if we turn our attention to that mental affliction, we're no longer focusing on the object that's feeding it. So there's nothing feeding it. So we can simply watch it and it can't go anywhere. It can simply pass. And so if we get in the habit of doing that, we break this acting on them. We stop this reaction mechanism. We can simply observe them arising and passing, arising and passing. Yeah.
What kind of practice? How do we get in that habit? By the kind of shamatha you're mentioning?
Yeah, so that's one of the reasons that I particularly like this style of shamatha practice of observing the mind. People find it more difficult because it's not a physical object, but there is these enormous side benefits that we will, through that practice, we'll more instinctively in our daily life have that habit of noticing when mental afflictions are arising and going, oh, look at that. And we don't need to fight with it. You know, often when mental afflictions arise, people go, oh, I don't want that, go away, go away. That's just like throwing petrol on the fire. So we don't need to fight with the mental afflictions. Of course, we don't need to allow them to take control of our mind, so we don't want to identify. All we need to do is simply be present and observe them. If we can observe them, they have no power. They can't do anything to us. Mental afflictions can only harm us if we give them power. And we give them power by identifying with them or trying to suppress them. If we can simply be present and observe them, they can't do anything to us. And every time we manage to observe them arise and pass, the habit of them coming up will start to get weaker because we're not feeding the habit. We're not feeding the habit of the mental afflictions. There's more to be said about that, but it's now time for lunch. So let's stop there on the chart and I'll return because there's a few more important things to say at these last three steps, but I'll finish that off in the afternoon session. So now then, maybe just a couple of discussion questions. So this morning we've been talking quite a little bit about attachment and anger. So the first question is, discuss practical methods for dealing with anger and attachment in your daily life. So discuss practical methods for dealing with anger and attachment in your daily life. What might be nice here is if you already have some method that you use and you find it quite effective, maybe you'd like to share that with the other people in the group to give them a help as well. The second question, and we're just starting to touch on this now, is how would mindfulness help us to overcome our mental afflictions? How would mindfulness help us to overcome our mental afflictions? And also, now we've been talking a couple of occasions and still more to come, we're going to talking about cognitive fusion. So the third question is, discuss the different ways in which we engage in cognitive fusion in our daily life. Discuss the different ways in which we engage in cognitive fusion in our daily life. Cognitive fusion, yeah. And unfortunately, it's quite pervasive. Yeah.
Can you give us the working definition that you're using for mindfulness?
Mindfulness is simply, literally the original Sanskrit word is to remember. So mindfulness is simply the ability to focus on an object without becoming distracted. To remember the object. I.e. to hold it and not get distracted. That's it. The second part of the third question is regarding this cognitive fusion and what impact that has on us and those around us. What impact that has on us and those around us. That's meaning when we engage in cognitive fusion.